So we are this seed. We are given this purpose. We are given this life with a purpose. And again, in fulfilling that purpose, we fulfill the purpose of God. I mean, really, how extraordinary when you think about that. It's not a small thing. It's a precious human life. A precious human life with a precious purpose. And Murshid is calling us to awaken to that life and to that purpose. So for a moment, for a few moments here, look within. Let the light of your breath carry you on a current to the core of your being. That also sounds like a simple thing to do, but do we really know how to do that? Do we know how to get to that still essence? The still essence of our being. The point from which everything unfurls and unfolds in this life. Beyond all the confusion and the dramas and the words and the external circumstances. That part. That spark. Again, this beautiful phrase of Murshid's, of Hazrat and Icon's, the accomplishment of the purpose of life, the accomplishment of the purpose of life, the purpose of creation is fulfilled. In the accomplishment of the purpose of life, the purpose of creation is fulfilled. Therefore, in the fulfillment, it is not that man attained, but that God has fulfilled his purpose. God has fulfilled his purpose. And another way of hearing that, perhaps, is this Rumi poem. And today in Kansas City and perhaps other places in the world, although the actual Urs of Jalaluddin Rumi is the 17th of December, today there's celebrations going about in Kansas City. Some after this event as well. So it's appropriate to consider some of the great mystical poetry of Rumi. And these are translations by Coleman Barks, who is fantastic in terms of assimilating Jalaluddin Rumi to the Western mind. All day I think about it, then at night I say it. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? My soul is from somewhere else. I'm sure of that. And I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in the aviary. The day is coming when I fly off, but who is it now in my ear? Who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I can't stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I could break out of the prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. The purpose of life. In attaining our own purpose, we attain the purpose of God. And Murshid said we can do it in intoxication or we can do it in soberness. They both end up in the same place. But if you follow that line of thought for a while, you can see that the paths would be traveled in very different ways, and consequences along the way would also be different. That's a whole series of classes in and of itself. I leave you to think about it. So the main body of teachings that we began, well, actually months and months ago, but last month we had a reading called Training the Mental Ego. But it's also, in some transliterations, they're not really translations, because Hazarat and Icon spoke and taught in English, we can see that sometimes the title is given to this paper, The Training of the Ego, Training by Not Gratifying Vanity. So I wanted to read a few phrases that perhaps you'll recall from last month, and then we'll move forward. The first form of the body is that which the body helps to form. I have to go back, I said that wrong. The first form of the ego is that which the body helps to form. And the next is that which is formed by the mind. Interesting when we think about that, even how we take form in the womb. Of course, there are a lot of philosophical and theological debates at what point does consciousness enter, but we do know and we do can document that in a very physical way, the body taking form in the womb. And in some ways that child, each one of us, has come out purely innocent, purely blank, ready to be taught, so that then we sit here today trying to unlearn some of those things so that we can be, again, who we really are, but with some knowledge of the world. So again, this aspect of the ego lives for vanity, the aspect of mind he's speaking of here, Murshid speaks of, which causes a person to do good and also to do evil. Its desire is always the satisfaction of its pride, and when this increases in the end, it results in tyranny and cruelty. Have you ever heard of the expression, cutting off one's nose to spite one's face? That can also be that, you know, people will purposefully go against the grain just because of pride. They don't want to go with the flow or with the natural tendency of things as they're unfolding. It's interesting. But some people, in spite of whatever the best outcome would be, or the best decision, would do that. That's pride. We have it in many ways. Pride isn't always a bad thing. It can be used to help raise us up to be more than we ever thought we could be. But when it becomes tyrannically exposed or used in a cruelty towards another, we have to be mindful of that. Murshid says, the more vanity a person has, the less sympathy he has for others. For all his attention is given to his own satisfaction. And he is blind towards others. Ego, so to speak, restricts life. Ego, so to speak, restricts life. Because it limits a person. It puts us in a kind of prison. Coldness, pride, jealousy, all come from the ego. The outward manner cannot hide an ego that is not soft. Even if the manner is very humble, it shows itself suddenly, unconsciously, in a word or an action that jars upon another. Any thoughts or questions about what we've read so far? How do we get out of the prison? No one cares to know. Any guesses? How do we get out of that prison?
Being aware of it would be helpful.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it?
To start.
It's a good start. Yeah, in a way, it's kind of being ruthlessly honest with oneself. We don't have to tell those deepest, darkest secrets to someone else. It helps sometimes to tell them to a spiritual friend or companion, because that person can encourage you. But as soon as we feel there's a push away, you can be sure there's something to be learned there. And it's the ego wanting to protect itself, not wanting to look at that, not wanting to take responsibility, that, you know, will give that pushback, or will want to blame another person, or it's their fault, or they've misunderstood. That's ego, and it's a prison. Today, I see some expressions of, really, what's she really talking about? I want to read something that came today in the Bowl of Sake. These are teachings by Murshid. And I thought it was very beautifully put. And then there are a collection of other teachings from cited from other parts of Murshid's message that highlight this. And I think it might help to illuminate the point. So, as the rose blooms amidst thorns, so great souls shine out through all opposition. That's the quote. That's the Bowl of Sake for today. Let me go down, because there's one piece of it that seems very important. Murshid talks about this. He says, there was a small group of people in London who were working along spiritual lines. They felt a sort of rivalry against my little society, the Sufi movement. And they began to try to do us harm by telling stories against us and by setting others against us. My helpers came to tell me how we were being damaged in this way and asked if we shouldn't do something to stop this. I answered, the best way to treat this is with indifference. I mean, that takes a lot of control, doesn't it? To not want to react, to not want to respond, to not want to justify, to not want to say, wait a minute, you're confused, don't do this, this is slanderous, this is damaging, etc. Just be indifferent. And he says further, take no notice. He goes on to say, and when they insisted that these doings would do us great harm, I said, not at all. The only harm it could do would be if we allowed this harm to enter our circle. Let them do as they like, and let them go on doing what they are doing. As the years went by, they never heard us say a word against them. On the contrary, we welcomed them, we helped them, we served them in whatever way we could. In time, this resistance completely vanished. We have been going forward, and they still stand where they were. Just a little indifference was enough. Does it help to see things that way? I mean, the mind really wants to push back. You know, the ego, the mind ego. Even in the thinking, how do you get out of that? How do you stop it?
Isn't that a tool, too?
Well,
in your ego providing that abrasion, that friction that allows you to grow by the opposite, by its own opposition?
Oh, yes. It depends on if it's turned inward to gain insight and to sand our own parts, or if we feel we have to go do that on everybody around us.
Absolutely.
That's why I've often quoted the Dalai Lama saying, think of those that hurt you and harm you as the great teacher, the great guru who teaches you strength and courage. Yeah. It's a great blessing. It doesn't feel like it at the time, but it can be, certainly. But noticing, you know, this started, Sharif, when you said, it'd be good to be aware of it. It'd be good to be aware of it. And that's what I'm saying. What are those, I guess what I'm saying here is, what are those indicators that make us aware? And I think that there are schools of thought where, you know, if we have the tendency to want to resist, to want to answer back, to want to strike out, to want to make somebody else wrong, to want to justify, these are things that are indicators to us that something needs to, that, to help us become conscious. I mean, that indifference. I mean, think of Mirsha being, you know, sacrificing his mother country, coming to a new land, trying to start with this vision, this, you know, it wasn't a new religion, it was just a broader thought than maybe other confined ways of looking at spirituality, and then there are people talking against him. Of course you're thinking, my God, I've given up my whole life as I've known it, and here are a group of people trying to destroy this. What did he say? Be indifferent, take no notice, let them do what they do. It's interesting, we never see this on with our political candidates, for example. Something happens, the next day they're all over the news and every talk show trying to justify themselves. It's the way we've learned. It's the way we've learned. But it's not, you know, the difference is, and I remember Pir Vilayat would tell us this a lot of times in retreat. He'd say, the exact words are not coming to mind. If they do, I'll share them at some point. But the whole point was, here it is. And Hazrat Anayat Khan also talks about it. There is a vast difference between human law and divine law. So the human tendency, the human law wants to answer back, to do something, to justify. But the divine purpose, to withhold that, to let one observe oneself and one's reaction, is the great victory. And this is training of the mind, the ego, the mind ego, the second layer of ego, the first being the body, then the next one being the mind. Is that helpful? Yeah? Okay. I'm going to go back a little bit to these other teachings that we had previously, because they were in the first section, but they do beautifully highlight this teaching on the training of the ego, vanity. Murshid says this, and I want to lead up to a practice here. So just let these words, you know, again, no clinging. Everything will be posted online. The references will be there. Links will be there. It's good. I appreciate you taking notes. It's good because when something really sticks with you and you write it down, it's helpful. But then you can also go back online. If you know, you can listen to the audio files. You can also listen to the audio-visual, and you can look at the outline. So I don't want you to feel like you have to cling to what's being said, but let it kind of wash through the mind stream. So again, this is from the training of the ego, vanity. And this is from the first section, the first part of these teachings. And Murshid says this, the ego not only makes man self-conscious, but it makes him a coward and renders him helpless. He is timid because he sees his own limitations, and he is helpless because everything stronger overpowers him. As he confines his being within a certain limit. This is another reason we want to sometimes push back or run away. It's very interesting. It's because there's a limitation there. We feel small, we feel incapable of functioning within that circumstance. Besides all the other disadvantages of self that self-consciousness brings with it, there is about all else one thing it does. It prevents man from realizing that the thought of self keeps him away from God. We talked about that last week, or last month, we focused on that. In the heart of man, there is room for only one, either himself or God. In Tibetan Buddhism, we hear it said that if we're suffering, and we know that, I know that, I hope you know that, I'll keep saying it again until we all know it, but the minute we're feeling bad in some ways about ourselves, it's said that we can be assured that we're self-cherishing, that we've become too aware of oneself, and if we can shift that view, it's paradoxical, isn't it? Because in one way, we want to become very conscious of things. But we can also get in it and want to just go over and over and over and over and over it. And that can be very harmful to us. It makes a very deep impression in the mind. But then if we switch that view, I remember reading something by Sogyal Rinpoche, and he said, the best protection of my mind is prayer. Well, what if instead of going around and around in one's mind, one just says, okay, I'm going to stop and I'm going to focus on prayer. It can shift things. It will shift things. But here, again, I want to talk about something. I'm not supporting or promoting any kind of idea of repression here either. I mean, if you're talking about a contemporary psychological terms, not squishing it, but I'm asking people to look at it, to look at it, to look at it. Everything has a natural process of healing. If you get a cut on your hand, what happens first? It may bleed, but then it becomes very red and it becomes very tender. Well, if we get a wound in our heart, in our mind, it is the same. There is going to be some bleeding, the bleeding heart, so to speak. We're going to feel something very deeply. We're going to be very aware of it at every touch, just like if you get even a small little paper cut on your hand. Oh my God, how bad that can hurt. But then, over time, the skin starts to pull together and heal itself. We do that too. We call in the fragments that have been hurt and we kind of come back into wholesomeness. That's what wholesomeness means. The parts become whole. We become whole. It's a process. And sometimes that cycle can be very long for people. But the more one becomes conscious of it, which is what we're talking about in these teachings, the more we can help ourselves go through that in a more beautiful, productive way. And maybe even somewhat of a less painful way. And when we help ourselves, we help the vibrations around us and we help the world in that awakening. So this will also be very interesting for you to hear. We'll read just a little bit more on this paper. I'm actually moving to another paper. Let me just highlight that. This is again from the first body of these teachings. And it will be in the outline. It's called Training the Ego, the Three Parts of the Ego. And Murshid talks about the first part is the physical body. And he says, the ego is divided into three parts, the physical ego, the mental ego, and the spiritual ego. And I've talked about this. I've made these analogies to the coconut, the hard outer shell, the body, the white flesh being mental, and the milk or the space inside being the soul. And then he talks about the ego, the cover over, and now it's the physical ego, the cover over one's mental and spiritual being becomes thicker and thicker until it closes all light from within. It becomes thicker and thicker until it encloses all light within. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the world. Very beautiful thing he's saying here. The body is an instrument for the soul to experience the external world. But if the whole life be devoted to the instrument, to the physical body, then the person for whom the instrument exists is deprived of it to experience his full experience in life. So it's just a very, just only that first level, that first layer that's experiencing life. And then he goes on to talk about this in a somewhat humorous way. So I'm going to read this. It's very short. The blindness of the physical ego. The blindness that the physical ego causes can be clearly seen among the lower creations. How the lion is inclined to fight with another lion. I mean, why? He just came close to where you are. It doesn't matter. It's going to let him have it. This is my space. And how a dog is inclined to watch a bone off which he's already eaten the flesh. Yet it does not want another dog to touch it. It's my bone. It's my toy. It's my person. It's my car. It's my this. It's my that. On and on. In this physical this same physical ego gives man pride in his strength. Now we're getting back to that idea of pride. In his beauty, in his power, in his possessions. If there is a spark of light in it, it must expand to a shining star. And when there is the slightest darkness, that darkness must expand and put the whole of life in a mist. So it's like, how do we illuminate that? How do we create an illuminated physical body, one that's well cared for, one that's well tended, nourished, rested, okay? Benefited by prayer and meditation. Okay, it helps to create a lightness, but when we start to darken the body, it darkens the whole world. In the intoxication of the physical ego, man becomes so interested in the satisfaction of his appetites, only he can readily harm or injure or hurt, not only himself, his enemy, and his dearest friend. As a drunken man does not know what he says or does, so a person blinded with his physical ego is intoxicated and can easily say or do things regardless of the pleasure, comfort, happiness, harmony, or peace of others. Has anyone done that? Has anyone ever done or said something that you've regretted? And has anyone ever done or said something to you that it's been hard for you to recover from? Okay. Well, again, the question is, how do we overcome it? How does that not shape us and imprison us? How do we not go about blaming someone for these conditions in our lives? Oh, we're not free when we do that, are we?
One thing you realize is their perception. It could have nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
It's how they see things.
Yeah. Could be a limitation within their own consciousness. Mm-hmm. That's good. What else?
Or it could be true, but I've always heard that the God-centered person should never take praise or blame too seriously.
Right. Same. They're the same. Indifference, which Mercia talked about it earlier. Yeah. And it's also talking about that vanity, that we often are led by that, by other people's impressions of us, that we thrive on that, in fact.
Well, that's also the other person's weight to carry.
Okay.
Their opinions, they're get excited and get down on you or whatever, and saying that's pretty much your weight, your life, not mine.
Yeah, but our lives are intertwined, aren't they? And
it's that awareness of the, who's in charge kind of thing.
Yeah, who is in charge? The one. The one.
I can share an example about Al on November 26th outside the Glenwood Theater. He drove up to Double Park and let Mummy and myself out to go to a movie. And all of a sudden, the big Johnson County bus pulled into him. Well, cool, calm, and collected. Poor Al, he wasn't going to do anything about it. He was just going to let it happen. And I said, no, it's okay. Just call the police, make a report, do this, do that. Sure enough, no one was going to do anything. He didn't want his insurance company to do this and that. So I just handled it. Bing, bing, bing. Cool, calm, nice, like each person is God and precious. Bingo, $1,200 came in the mail yesterday to Al.
Take care of it.
Yeah, if you just speak up. Because, you know, he wasn't guilty. He wasn't innocent.
Right.
And there's no reason why you should put up with all the abuse that people can give you.
Yeah.
So, you know, life works. Just stand tall for your beliefs.
Yeah. Again, I want to ask us the question, because sometimes that's easy. That piece may be easy. I don't know that it always is. Where we can say, oh, that's somebody else's perception. I don't know. Need to be... affected or offended or hurt by that, you know, that's their scene, whatever we want to say. But as long as there's a little bit of a reaction, we have to watch that. We have to watch that. And I think sometimes, does anyone find it hard for themselves to forgive themselves for something that they've done? Yeah. So how do we work with that? I mean, there are some practices that are given to us that we can work with. Would you like to explore those?
Are those Astaghfar Law?
Astaghfar Law is part of the core language that we would work with, but there are three wazifas, and they're called the forgiveness cluster. They deal with forgiveness, but forgiveness in different aspects. And some of you might be familiar with this teaching. We've studied it more deeply at some of the retreats and camps, and we've done it here. Ghafar, Ghafur, Tawab, Afu. In some ways, this and the practice for healing, to me, feels like it could be a lifelong practice. Because who doesn't need some sort of level of healing, even of these three levels of the ego, the physical, the mental, and the spiritual? What ways? And what about the offenses that have come to us? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So forgiveness has these many dimensions. And one of them is this overarching principle, like a salve, a balm that pours upon everything. A universal forgiveness. It could even be considered this kind of forgiveness that hides these, our sins, perhaps we could call it, or our misgivings, misactions, mistrust, misbehavior, whatever you want to call that. It hides it from others, while also it even maybe even hides it from ourselves. Because sometimes things can become so unbearable within ourselves, we can't find a way to forgive ourselves. And if only we could have a redo, right? And there can be a lot of regret. Well, how do we get beyond that? How can we heal beyond that? We have to be able to move on, but how's the question? Ghafar is the answer, in part. Ghafur is like this, it's like the sense of this universal forgiveness that enters into our being, maybe even like a laser, and goes to the very source of the whole issue, without guessing around it, without maybe this, maybe that, or it could be this, or didn't. Something happened to me a long time ago, and that's why I'm doing all this. No. It doesn't even require that. This goes to the very source that needs to be forgiven. First is spelled G-H-A-F-A-R, Ghafar, universal, all-enveloping, all-encompassing aspect of principle. Ghafur, G-H-A-F-U-R, goes right to the heart of the situation, penetrates like a laser. One doesn't even have to really even know. The wazifa, the practice, the sound, the mantra will go right to that source and help to heal and forgive. Tawab is meaning to turn away from. It's, in some ways, one has to say, I'm going to make a new beginning here. I have regret. I've made mistakes. I know that. But I'm learning from that. I'm going to turn completely away from that. And I'm moving on. Tawab is T-A-W-W-A-B. Tawab, one word. And the final wazifa is afu. Afu. And this is a sweeping principle. So we have this overarching principle with the first wazifa, a penetrating aspect of forgiveness with the second wazifa. The wazifa tawab gives us the strength to turn away and make a new beginning. And a fu is like this oversweeping principle that cleanses us from all of this in a way of forgiveness. A F U W, a fu. And these wazifas can be done all in a series together as one large wazifa. Shall we try it? It's okay, Leo. So just as the body is this thing that makes up the physical ego, it's good to engage the body in the prayer, engage the mind in the prayer, and God willing, the soul is kind of drawn along in that tail stream, okay, tailwind. So I would suggest that we make this motion with the head where it comes up with Yagafar and down the penetrating motion, Ghafur, Yagafur, Tawab, turn to your left, and Afu, turn to your right. Now this is also making this beautiful motion of the sign of the cross, which Murshid says is the greatest protection there is for us. It joins heaven and earth, the aspect of ourselves which is metaphysically talked about. The left side is the heart of man, woman. The right is the soul. The left is imperfection, and the right is perfection. So we're touching all of the parts of our being, as well as the heaven and the earth, with this motion. Remember that we say the wazifa in three different manners. The first one is aloud with the prefix ya, which is a term of endearment, one might say, and also respect, meaning, O divine one, O holy one, O my deepest friend, O dear. And then it follows with the wazifa. And then after that, we drop the ya, becomes more subtle, and we just whisper the wazifas. We can continue the head motion. And then we'll go silent And if you want to make a subtle motion with your head, you may. You may just close your eyes and make this motion. It's the same as. Yagafar, Yagafur, Yatawab, Yaafu. 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 Whisper. Now on the breath, breathe in, Gafar, and out, Gafur, and in, Tawab, and out, Afu. And release the practice, and observe. Observe the body, observe the mind. And deeper yet, if one can touch that seed, get a glimpse of the soul. As many times as you can. The practices are typically done in a sequence of 101. So the first might be in Sufism we do it 100. Leo, is it our mailman?
The postman.
Good work, Leo. Good work.
He's a good. So you would say the first set out loud, with preceding the wazifa with ya, as we did 34 times.
34.
Then the next 34, you would say them in a whisper. And the last 33, just feeling the vibration internally. Keeping the wazifa alive on the breath, with the thought on the swing of the breath. And, you know, just take your beads. If they're 108, I set mine a little, you could tie a little string where your 33 or your 34 bead is and do that, because I also have the Buddhist mala like that, so you can use that as well.
There are only 23 beads.
Yeah.
Got any idea what they mean?
They're also done for, used for practice.
Okay.
Yeah, they're also small little wrist mala. Okay.
Should one be conscious of the meanings of the wasifa or just the vibration?
During the entire practice?
Yeah.
Well, I think I've said to you before, when my Murshida gave me my practices, I never received an explanation.
There you go.
I had to do the practice. And then every month I had to write to her with what my experience or realization was of the practice. And once I got it, we moved on. There's so much information now that's available in print and there's the tendency to want to self-prescribe, but I didn't dare think of doing that myself on my in my path of discipleship, nor do I. I still confer with others, Murshid Hidayat and such. I think it's good to have that reflection. And as part of our training within the Sufi movement, I think I've also mentioned that we would be asked to see if we could experience or feel an attunement with someone that had been working with a practice. So they would separate us into groups, and they would ask one group, they'd give them like three or four or five wazifas to pick from, and they would have to do a practice for a part of the time. And then they would ask us to sit with that person to see if we could feel, discern the vibration of the practice. So it's very subtle, you know. You feel the vibration and the atmosphere. And that's real, you know, I have to say that's real esoteric training. A lot of talking and things doesn't really get you there necessarily. And a lot of ecstatic practices don't necessarily get you there. It's kind of, yesterday I was watching The View. Did you watch it, Mom? And they were talking about people dieting at this time of year and how difficult that can be. And Whoopi Goldberg, who can be very direct, said, look, folks, let's just put it this way. You want to lose weight? You got to get your butt to the gym and work out. And it's kind of like that. You want to get illumination? You kind of have to concentrate the mind and do the practice. Otherwise, you can feel happy for a little while, but then what happens when you don't? Do you know what to do? Can your practice help you? Can you go to the breath? Do you know how to change your mind? You know how to go to a practice? And once you've been given a practice, that's always yours. But it's like putting a child in a pharmacy and let them grab all the pretty pills and start to take them. Just because you like something doesn't mean it's necessarily good for you. I've had people report to me that they've decided that they should do that, and there have not always been the best results from that. Things have been that there can be something that arises through the working with a wazifa, especially if it isn't the proper time or within concert of that person's unfoldment, it can do something completely startling and very different. So, you know, I just say that as a precaution. Anyone watching on the web that thinks it's good to just like take things up, you know, here's the caveat or the Surgeon General's warning here on these practices. You know, be mindful and work with a living guide. It's important. Is that clear? So, yes, while it's good to know what the meaning is, what are you experiencing is very, very important. You know, I mean, I didn't learn that way, but it has validated my own understanding by having been taught or mentored in that different way. Can you see the value of that, too? It gives one a lot of conviction about the practice, knowing the result. Yes, that's right. And the way it's been described to me, which I think is a beautiful description, and some of you've heard this before, it's that at first, you know, it's as if we're drawing attention. You know, it's like, when my students first address me at the college, you know, it's Professor Sabato, Professor Sabato, Professor Sabato, right? This is, oh dear, oh divine one, can I approach you and ask you to come into me with this practice? Then later it's like, listen, drop the professor, you know, just call me Stephanie, mm-hmm. Okay? So then it's like, no Professor Sabato, no, you know, whatever, it's Stephanie. And that way we drop the ya. And then later, I'm not even Stephanie, I'm just Steph, like short name. And some of them say to me that I'm even too cool for that, so they just call me Tss. So I've just become a sound now. It's like Tss. Tss. Okay. So, just a little humor there, but it illustrates the point, doesn't it? It's like as we familiarize ourselves with that practice, it becomes a deeper part of our being, and we don't have to call so aloud to it in such a formal way.
It might love to come.
They're living beings. They're not just words. They're living vibrations, by the way. They're living beings. I hope you know that.
What if you told them to call you Nuri?
Well, they know that name too, but I don't use that professionally. Yeah. It's a special name.
Okay. What was your question?
The question was about dropping the ya.
Oh, his, yeah, but he said something.
Did I have a question? I had a question about the practice, and David asked then.
No, it was just a second ago.
Just a second ago. Maybe you heard something. Yeah. Not that it's important to do that, but if someone has a question about the practice or would like to share something about the practice. We only did it, by the way, Diane, 33 times. We did 11, 11, 11 today. Okay. Here, Vilayato also used to say that to recite the name once with great sincerity was of more benefit than reciting hundreds and hundreds of times. But what the recitation does is it sets up the vibration that we experience and witness and recognize. It's a kind of additive process, like dyeing fabric. The more we say it, the more we become it. We deepen in its coloration, in its tonality, in its meaning. Does that make sense? So there's value in the repetition also. Very much so. And the other thing, as Sogyal Rinpoche, it becomes a seal or a protection for the mind when we set up this vibration and we recite the Wazifa again and again. Any comments from our online participants? You can write it in the chat window if you'd like to share, and I can read it aloud.
Gafar, G-A-F-A-R?
G-H.
G-H.
And, you know, God forgive me, I'm probably not saying it just correctly. It has probably more of an aspiration with the G-H. Gah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know?
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Pronunciations I've heard.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move on.